errors or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll be joined by AFGE Communications Director Enid Doggett, who will discuss communications tips for union members, and Wall Street Journal personal finance columnist Karen Blumenthal to learn about her new book, The Guide to Starting Fresh. But first, we'll discuss the increased violence in federal prisons with Council of Prison Locals President Dale Desotel. Dale, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So there has been an outbreak of violence at the Bureau of Prisons recently at the Federal Detention Center, SeaTac, in Seattle, and the United States Penitentiary, Coleman, in Florida. What can you tell us about these incidents?
Overall, these incidents are becoming alarmingly too frequent. It seems that the inmates have become more violent. It seems that they have no respect for staff, and it seems like they have no fear or of retaliation or consequences. In SeaTac, the officer was attacked with a lock in a sock, we call it. We give the inmates padlocks to protect their personal property in their cells, and here they turn around and put the lock in one of their socks and use it as a weapon, and he suffered three skull fractures, had to undergo surgery, and is now entering into therapy. It's terrible that an officer be attacked, and for what reason? We don't know. Had there been two officers on the unit, as it was prior to 2005, prior to the initiative of Mission Critical, you know, it would be harder for an inmate to attack an officer. Down in Coleman, the officer noticed that one of the inmates in the cell block was under the influence of some kind of alcohol or some kind of what we call in the system hooch, homemade wine of some sort, and was vomiting. And so he contacted the lieutenant and told him what he had, and the lieutenant told him to send him up to him. He said, "Wow, man, send him up there? What, he's in that condition, I don't know." So he called the officer in the wing next to him. In other words, he was in D unit, and he called the officer from C unit or vice versa. I'm not real sure, but there's two units. There's a C and a D unit. And he called the officer over to assist him. And the inmate that was in the cell with him came out and attacked him as soon as they opened the door when they were trying to take care of the guy that was intoxicated. So I don't know what's gotten into these inmates' minds. And as we discussed it today, we are actually visited today by our new director, Charles Samuels, and he has already expressed to us this morning that he is going to put out a declaration or some direction to the inmates and wanting them to know that this is not going to be tolerated. There will be consequences, and, you know, under the law, we will try to do what we can. The problem is we're overcrowded, and we're losing our spaces in our special units. So we have to work on all of these issues so that we can maintain or try to instill some consequence for these inmates that have just taken over and decided that they're going to assault staff. So it's a positive thing, as he speaks to us this morning, and I certainly want to work with him on it, and however we can accomplish that to give our staff more safety and to get a better control over these inmates until we're able to get the funding and get more staff in these units. That's about all we can do. So it is imperative that we get the funding so that we can continue to manage this inmate population that is totally, it's overcrowded. They're getting restless as well. I mean, put yourself in their shoes. They are living in confines that are not pleasant at all. And, you know, I know for some people who say they earned it, yes. But how do you maintain some kind of degree of dignity or sanity or sanitation, for that matter, without proper staffing? and without proper facilities. That's the challenge that we face.
Dale, let's talk for a minute about the situation at SeaTac. You mentioned that the officer who was working at the time was alone. What's the impact there of having officers who are, and it should be noted, unarmed inside a federal facility,
correct,
who are now oftentimes working by themselves in a specific housing unit or something like that? What's the impact there?
The impact is, number one, you have no one to, so to speak, have your back. There's no backup. We watch on the TV on our favorite police shows, they call for backup. That's the first step. You call for backup. But many times, in this particular situation in SeaTac, the inmate came right out attacking, assaulting. He had no time to respond. In fact, the rumor is, and I don't want to say it's a fact, but the other inmate actually is the one that hit the body alarm so that other staff could respond. Had it not been for that, perhaps we would have had another fatality. It seems that the inmate had some reason to assault him and looked like he had intentions of actual murder on his mind. I don't know. I wasn't there. But for any person to be in a cell block with the inmates, you are alone. And all you have is that radio. And again, you know, up until Mission Critical, we had two staff members each in each wing, in each unit. So we had our backs. We had someone to have our backs, especially when the inmates were out in the common area. Even when we go into special housing areas, we don't unlock that cell door until the inmate is cuffed and there's two staff members there. That's the policy. That's the only way you can ensure safety and ensure you don't lose the integrity of the unit. But in these housing units, we don't anticipate inmates that have these problems because, number one, we don't have enough staff to walk and talk and try to discern or ascertain information that the inmates are disgruntled or they got some news from home that's not good or they have an issue with a staff member or they have an intention to either harm staff because they're in a gang or for whatever motive that they may have to harm staff is unknown at the time. And so it's difficult to maintain control or to even anticipate some kind of an assault. You just don't know it's there. And if you're alone and it happens, thank God some of the other inmates had taken upon themselves not to be involved with no crime scene, so to speak. So that's, if that's just a rumor, then I'll take it as such. But if somebody had to respond, now I don't know how, but they responded. His alarm went off, so thank God for that.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Council of Prison Locals President Dale Desotel. Dale, you also mentioned that the inmate was essentially armed with what you called a lock and a sock.
Correct.
How alarmed are you by that, knowing that correctional officers not only are outnumbered many times by about 150 to 1 by the inmates, but also they have no means of protecting themselves with any protective equipment, weapons, anything like that?
Well, it's becoming increasingly alarming because they've always had them, and we've had these incidents before, but when we had more staff, they were less likely to use it unless they were really just irate or in a larger incident or larger scale situation where there were several of them that were trying to be disruptive or in a dispute among themselves. It's happened before, but it is increasingly alarming that they are utilizing anything and everything. That's a dangerous tool or a dangerous weapon. Imagine putting, a padlock and hitting someone with it. It's not going to break. Something is going to break, but it's not going to be that lock. If you get one shot, there's no protection on our heads. We don't have a baton. We don't have the pepper spray. So we're at risk or we are vulnerable to any type of attack. But these inmates today don't find anything. We had an incident at USP Lee back in the fall where an inmate took an ink pen and stabbed one of our officers 7 or 11 times. I can't even remember, but just tried to stab him all over his face, trying to get him in the eye or what have you. The inmates today are just using anything and everything that they can. Is it a cry for help? Is it a cry, you know, to us for them to get moved? There's all kinds of motives. But the officer remains at risk because we don't have the protection, and all we have is a camera for after the incident reviews, which is not very helpful to a person that gets injured and gets 3 skull fractures.
Dale, you mentioned that you're meeting with the new director, Mr. Charles Samuels, today.
Yes.
Are you confident that he will understand your concerns about the low staffing and funding levels and the dangers, the safety issue that's occurring inside the Bureau of Prisons?
I am. It's inspiring to hear him speak. He was a correctional officer. He began his career there. And he has been in charge of Correctional Programs Division here lately. And he has spoken this morning on his intentions, as I said, to make sure that these inmates get a directive that they understand there are going to be consequences to the best of his ability. Therein lies the other challenges of funding and overcrowding and lack of facilities and lack of areas, lack of special management units that he would like to increase. But all of this costs money, and it takes staff to do it. So he is aware, and he sounds that he is aware, and he sounds like he's committed to working with us for the safety of staff. It's his number one goal, and to protect our oath that we made as correctional officers or federal law enforcement officers as well, and also to uphold the mission of the agency. And all of that is becoming increasingly challenging because of, you know, the external pressures of funding and overcrowding and the lack of facilities, not to mention the laws that we are having to function under to protect the rights of the inmates as well, keep them safe from themselves and from those that may cause them harm in the institution as well. So it is a very stressful situation, a very tight situation, but he has expressed his concerns and has given us his commitment that he wants to work with us and work through these issues and try to make it, bring it back to where we can function as a team and we can function safely. So we're inspired by his words this morning.
Dale Desotel, president of AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. Dale, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss communications tips for union members with AFGE Communications Director Ina Doggett.
Attention AFGE members. Are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit available to AFGE members where you can buy brand-name laptops, tablets, and home appliances through 12 months of easy payroll deduction. No upfront cash or credit check required. Shop now and get an 8% AFGE member-only discount with promo code AFGE member. That's all one word. Learn more. Visit ShopPurchasingPower.com today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're joined now by Enid Doggett, AFGE's Communications Director. Enid, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Jason. It's always a pleasure to talk with you about things that are going on within the AFGE Communications Department.
So speaking of, as we open up 2012, Enid, what are you looking forward to most in leading AFGE's communications efforts?
The one thing personally and professionally I'm looking forward to is the opportunity to clarify and reposition federal employees and the importance of the work that they do day to day. As Dale just illustrated, the impact that federal employees have on citizens' day-to-day lives are often overlooked because of things that come into play, you know, images of federal employees as the lazy federal employee who's not doing day-to-day. People forget that federal employees are the folks who inspect their water, who inspect their food, who protect the troops and who protect communities in terms of the situations with the Bureau of Prisons where they are containing dangerous criminals.
Why do you think that is such a challenge? And I'm referring to the image, changing the image of federal employees to the public.
I think because there are competing interests. I mean, there are people who believe that government should not play as large a role, and they've been able to drive home the point politically as well as through a lot of communications and in some cases some mishaps that weren't done by dedicated civilian employees but by contractors or by other management officials who had agendas that didn't necessarily jive with the public needs.
Where do you think that idea came from about federal employees not being valuable or not being worthy of what they're doing?
That's an interesting question. I'm not really quite sure to how that idea was seeded and how it grew. I know that in a lot of cases it's politically expedient until, you know, the member of Congress who is charging federal employees with, you know, being lazy or being inept deals with the federal employees who service the needs of the public in his particular district or state.
And it's important to note that, you know, becoming a federal employee is a difficult task. They are very specialized in their work. It takes a long process to become a federal employee. Only the most qualified candidates even get interviews, let alone get the job. So we're talking about a very skilled, a very dedicated, a very educated workforce.
That's correct. And not only that, not to mention the level of commitment. I mean, by example, I can point to our Social Security employees who last year staged demonstrations nationwide across the country to illustrate the impact that closing service centers would have on the public and to also to get the public engaged in what they feel is a very strong move to move Social Security systems to the internet, where you have a lot of people that subscribe to or need Social Security services on a regular basis who have no internet access. That's by example.
So as we move forward and get started on 2012, do you have any specific projects in mind that you will launch to improve this image of federal employees and tell the stories of the work that people at SSA or the Bureau of Prisons or the Department of Veterans Affairs do?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we are expanding our training program. We feel that it's imperative that our members become more fully engaged, not just in social media, but that they improve their communication skills. That, you know, as a union, that we become less defensive and more offensive in how we execute our messages to the public, and that we do some education. By example, our EPA council has launched a Save the EPA campaign, which does describe and talk about a lot of the jobs and a lot of the functions and their impact, not just on the environment, but on the public well-being.
You mentioned social media. How has that changed the way that the communications department goes about its work?
Well, we've actually expanded our social media platforms. Primarily we are Facebook and Twitter, but we are also Tumblr and we're Bitly and a number of other lesser known social media entities. But it has expanded our ability to reach and connect with our members. And in turn, we would like to expand the services that our members are able to give to their members, our member leaders are able to give to their members. We're concentrating in our new training program emphasizing how this can help solicit membership as well as maintain and educate our members about the various services that AFGE has overall.
Now, you bring up an interesting point because as our members obviously know, AFGE is a ground-up run organization where the members, they go out and they touch people and they communicate with their communities and whatnot. As a communications professional, what sort of advice can you give to our members at the local level or the council level in how to spread the message of AFGE?
I think the biggest thing, we touched on social media as an entity, and I think that there is some education that needs to go about how that can actually make it the process of connecting with members easier. But the biggest thing is to keep it simple. I think that the people give an aura because communications, news media, and things like that, these are things that they see every day. They listen to the radio, or they watch television, or they listen to the news, or they go to a web online news site every day. And yet they get sometimes caught up in the weeds of how to develop a media strategy. And that's what our department is for. We can provide a level of expertise, and we do have a blog site, AFGE comsquadtraining.wordpress.com, that does carry a lot of the tools they need. But I think that the biggest thing is for our members to keep it simple and also to relax. The news media is not necessarily the enemy.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with AFGE Communications Director Enid Doggett. Enid, let's talk for a minute about the capabilities of the Communications Department.
Okay, well, we do have a number of products. We put out, as you well know, the government standard regularly, as well as the RepWing, which is an electronic publication that we produce, which is written by Tim Kaufman. And we also put out the Capitol Report, which, again, Tim also manages. In addition to that particular publication, Christina Erling, who does our Social Security media, produces a product called The Real Deal for our Social Security councils. We, of course, have the AFGE radio program. Chelsea Bland manages our social media. And Sydney Glass, who is now my secretary, for those of you who didn't know, Chelsea has moved on and upward. Sydney is dealing with our district, our NEC media, helping to service our districts and our local. For instance, we have a union blog, which is still very well traveled, and we'd love for our members to make submissions. But we also write stories about things that are kind of off the beaten track. For instance, if one of our union locals helps build a house with Habitat for Humanity, that's something that we would like to publish. Size. And, you know, there are other things like, you know, if one of our locals does something outstanding with a laugh contribution, or they pay off the mortgage for their building, we want to get those kind of stories publicized. We do that through a union blog.
Now, as someone who has been in the communications profession for quite some time, particularly here in Washington, how important is it to have a sound and functioning communications or public relations department within an organization to make sure that the organization is operating effectively?
I think that it's critical, and that's one of the things that I wanted to say about our members. And I think that even if you have someone within your local or within your district who can provide a level a function or can serve as a person that can communicate or be, if you will, your liaison to the public or even your liaison to our department, that's critical. I think that every department within AFGE working together is what strengthens the communications of our union as a whole. And I think that our locals and our NEC and our districts have a lot of tools and a lot of people with capabilities that can contribute to that overall. The other thing that I did want to say that is very important, and one of the things that we are going gangbusters this year, is with our TSA campaign, which is, of course, headed by Emily Ryan, who also this year will be working very closely with our grassroots and legislative departments on our 2012 campaign. And I wanted to make note of the importance of departments working collaboratively to stress that our voter protection 2012 campaigns are going to be critical in terms of the interaction and how our departments gel with the other departments within AFGE.
Now, obviously, evolving technology impacts everyone in the world around us. But in particular, how does it impact the work that you do as a communications professional? I mean, we're no longer really faxing things around very much. It's all scanned email, etc. How does that sort of thing impact your day-to-day work?
It You know, it used to be, I used to joke that it was a 24-hour cycle, and now I joke that it's a 26-hour cycle, and you better be 2 hours ahead of everything. And I think one of the ways that we all keep ahead within our department is that we all have regularly monitor Twitter feeds. And that has become invaluable just in getting a snapshot of what's going on in the community, what's going on in, you know, with various news organizations. And that's one of the ways we keep track. We also keep track. I have to give a shout out to Mashable just because that is the primary, primary source of what's going on, keeping ourselves up to date on the latest in technology. One of the things that recently I discovered was Justin TV, which allows people to broadcast live from, as long as they have a webcam, or even a webcam on their phone, they can broadcast live from any entity. So technology is continuing to expand our reach, and our ability to keep up with it is critical as a department to how we are able to manage and connect and promote issues that are important to our members.
And lastly, Enid, how do you see the department fitting into the union's overall strategy as it relates to the presidential election coming up later this year?
We have a critical role to play on the ground in terms of communicating with our members internally for their activities, as well as communicating the role and the strength of federal workers in doing their jobs day to day. I think that the issues that we are dealing with are issues that impact Americans generally, and I think to the sense that we can emphasize and educate the public about the importance of the federal and DC workforce. We do represent DC workers, and their importance to Americans' daily lives will impact and have some impact on the federal elections coming up.
Enid Doggett, AFGE Communications Director. Always a pleasure to have you on the program, Enid.
Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, personal finance columnist Karen Blumenthal will discuss her new book, The Wall Street Journal Guide to Starting Fresh.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're joined now by Karen Blumenthal of the Wall Street Journal. Karen writes the Getting Going column and also the author of the new Wall Street Journal Guide to Starting Fresh, How to Leave Financial Hardships Behind and Take Control of Your Financial Life. Karen, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start by just getting an introduction on your new book. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, you know, these are some tough times for people. The people have lost jobs. They've faced financial challenges like losing their homes or having to seek bankruptcy. And then, you know, from time to time, unfortunately, things happen. People divorce, spouses pass away unexpectedly, and people find themselves in a new situation where they have to figure out, oh, gosh, now what do I do? And we took this approach with the idea that people could really use some hand-holding on the financial side. The sort of silver lining in these dark clouds is that your finances are something that you can control. You know, unlike the curveballs that life throws you, you know, where we unfortunately have no choices, you can do something about managing your money, about preparing for your future, about starting over. So we took that approach with this book. What do people need to know if they've had some kind of a setback, and how can they go forward with some confidence and some assurance that things are going to be better in the future?
I imagine this was a tricky book to write because there are so many uncertainties that could arise. I mean, you mentioned just a few: loss of a job, loss of a spouse, divorce, something like that. How did you go about sort of navigating through all these potential scenarios?
Yeah, that's a great question. There were certain themes, and so while we don't address every single aspect of those, I took a bigger look at what are the biggest themes that people need to know about. What do they need to know about credit going forward and credit scores? What do you need to know about your living situation? That's often a very tough one. Do I have to move? Should I move? Can I stay? I love my house. Can I stay? If it's, you know, something like a divorce or a job loss. What do I do about my retirement? You know, how can I be comfortable? How can I be sure that I'm providing well for my family? Those were sort of the bigger questions. What do I need to do for me in that? And that's the approach that I tried to take, and this was more, if you will, thematic. So it may not approach, it may not address, you know, a specific problem with, say, your own issues with debt. But we tried to take this approach that said, if you've had this kind of setback, these are the big themes, taking care of your health, taking care of your credit, worrying and taking care of your living situation, and this is what you can do about it.
What would be the biggest piece of advice that you could offer someone who's starting over in their financial life?
The first thing that I think people really need to worry about, boy, there's a lot of those. one of the things that I suggest, for instance, is when you've had a setback is to not do something right away. I mean, that's a bit cliched, but it's true, which is don't run into something, some big financial choice right off the bat, even though you may feel really panicked and feel like you need to do that. Generally, you're best taking your time, taking at least a few weeks or a month or more, and thinking through what your options are rather than rushing to do that. Because when you're in an emotional state, when something has really come out of left field and hit you hard, it's not a good time to be making those kinds of decisions. Chances are you're not going to make a good decision. So one thing is to take your time. Another really important piece of advice, I think, is to sort of set your priorities. And one of the priorities that I think people ought to put up front is making sure their health care is taken care of. You know, losing your health insurance or being without health insurance is one of those things that can set you back quite a bit more. And if you're already in a hole or set back, you don't need something bigger on top of that, like a health crisis, you know, a time in the hospital or medical treatment that then adds to your financial stress and your emotional stress. So taking your time and also making sure if your health care, if you have health insurance or you have a way to pay for your health care, that's a really important start.
That's a very interesting point and something that you had addressed relatively early on in the book, Chapter 3, I believe, taking care of your health. Many people might ask the question, well, what does my health have to do with my finances? But those two things are very closely linked. Talk a little bit about that.
They are. I mean, one of the main reasons, perhaps the main reason for bankruptcies in the United States is health costs. People get, and, you know, it can be a bit of a circle, if you will. You have a problem, you end up not being, two things. You end up not being able to work and running up health bills, and they can stack up, and those debts can pile up, and then you're really in a hole. And maybe you put some on your credit cards, and then the credit cards are maxed out, and now you've got, you know, financial problems all around. So, you know, one of the things, and it's difficult to do if you're without a job, or it's difficult to do if there's been a crisis. You know, you lost a spouse, and the spouse was employed and had health insurance. It's hard to know what to do. But I think taking care of that and making sure you can go to the doctor, that you can get help if you're having particular issues with grief or with physical issues, allows you then to think, you know, more broadly about other things if that's not a looming worry for you. So healthcare costs are a huge issue for people, especially in a setback. So, you know, I walk people through. In most cases, if you've left a job or your spouse recently had a job, you can buy insurance under COBRA, which allows you to buy the insurance you had before, but you pay the full premium. It's extremely expensive, but it's worth doing for a month or two to figure out what your other options are. There are other options. There is private insurance out there. There are perhaps trade groups or even church affiliations or things that you can participate in that could give you access to more reasonable health insurance. But you don't want to go naked because, you know, Murphy's Law, I think, will always apply. You just don't want to be without insurance if you can help it.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Karen Blumenthal, author of The Wall Street Journal Guide to Starting Fresh. Karen, when someone goes through a traumatic event in their lives and they need to reset their finances, what do you think is more important, focusing on saving for retirement or paying down any existing debt?
I'm going to give you one of those silly answers and say it's both. You need to find the right balance. It's not all or the other. So you're going to need retirement. If you're planning, most of us are going to need money in retirement, and most of us need to reduce our debt. So you need to find some balance and some way to accomplish both of them. And it may be splitting up whatever leftover income or whatever income you can make available to do that, paying down debt gradually and also contributing to your retirement. One of the things that's important about contributing to retirement is if you do end up in a huge financial problem and you have to file bankruptcy, your 401k is protected. So you do have some financial support for you waiting at the end of that process. And you want to protect that. You want to have some money in your retirement. If you blow through it now in your middle age, it's very, very hard to replace later on. So you need to do a little bit of both. One of the things, too, that I also recommend, and it may seem sort of contradictory, you're in a financial bind, you think you don't have any extra money. One of the things I recommend, actually, is to get some help, to find what I call a trust team who can help you through. And if you're really in a deep financial bind, there are nonprofit credit counseling services that will help you. And the very first session is to look at your budget and to try and work out a budget, and that's free. So if you need additional credit counseling, then there might be a very modest fee for that. But the initial session where you can work through a budget and see, exactly how bad things are, or really maybe things aren't nearly as bad as you think they are, and that can be incredibly worthwhile. If you can afford it, a financial planner, a session with a financial planner, or a couple of sessions, maybe a few hundred dollars, and that may be well worth it as well.
And how about a savings account? How does building an emergency fit into the overall plan?
Well, it depends on what situation you're in, obviously. If you've lost a job and you don't have any income, you're looking at maybe using that rainy day account. But if you've suffered some other kind of setback, perhaps a death of a spouse or a divorce, then what you want to do is build that emergency account or that rainy day account and have something there for you in the event of, things that happen, a trip to the emergency room, a tire that blows, and now you got to replace all four of them. The things that life sends your way that can hurt your budget. The really important part about those accounts and whatever you want to call them is that they keep you from getting into deeper trouble. If you have some money saved, if you have some money set aside, then you don't end up running up debt and you don't end up getting in that hole that we talked about that can get deeper and deeper when other things happen. So it's absolutely important to have some money set aside. One of the things, if you want to talk about that, I also talk about is the windfall. It's something you don't think about in a setback, but these often come with some kind of windfall, an insurance payment, a severance payment, a divorce settlement, some kind of chunk of money. And people find this very intimidating. Sometimes they want to go out and spend it right away. Sometimes they're so afraid of spending it that they don't know what to do with it. So one of the things I try and do is walk people through how to look at that windfall.
And do you think that the advice that you gave earlier in the segment about when you experience a setback, don't do anything right away, do you think that could apply to coming across a windfall as well?
Yeah, absolutely. What I try and tell people in the book is that windfall is actually committed before you get it. So just assume that it's already spent when it's come your way. Put it aside and then figure out how you're going to use it most effectively. So it may be that the first piece of it is your emergency account, and then it may be that a second piece of it is going to go to reduce debt, and a third piece is going to go to fund your retirement for the next, to add to your retirement accounts for the next couple of years. You sort of divide it up and look at it in pieces. If you've gotten a severance pay or severance package and you are unemployed and you're going to be looking for work, put it away. And if you really, you're going to need money to live on, pay yourself a paycheck. Figure out what your minimum needs are and pay yourself every month so that your bills are paid, but keep the rest of it away. It'll give you some assurance that it's there for you without making you feel like it needs to be spent or that it can't be spent.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue with The Wall Street Journal's Karen Blumenthal.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Karen Blumenthal, author of The Wall Street Journal, Guide to Starting Fresh. Karen, in the first segment, we had talked a little bit about surrounding yourself with good people and building a team that you can trust. Talk about the importance of that and also how to identify those right people.
Right. It can be tricky to find the right team for yourself, but it can really pay off because good advice will help get you going forward. And you know, you're going to need that when you're starting over. So I talk about three different areas in particular, a financial advisor. And I mentioned where you can go if your money is very tight. If you have resources to do it, you may want to look for a financial advisor. And there are all kinds of people out there with all kinds of credentials, but generally a certified financial planner, sometimes a CPA, or even sometimes a lawyer can help you with your finances. And you want to ask a lot of questions. You want to know their management style and what their financial and investment philosophy is. These things are not often discussed. I mean, people will say, oh, check their credentials and ask if they have continuing education and, do you like the way they look? But what you really want to know is, do you have a similar philosophy about money and money management? And do they talk to you and answer your questions in a way that you feel comfortable with? Because some people don't. I mean, some people find financial advisors sound like they come from another planet, and that's not going to be very helpful to you. You need to feel completely comfortable with the advice that you're getting and that you completely understand what the advisor is doing. I do think it's important for them to have some credentials and to have continuing education, and I also show ways you can check their backgrounds if you're concerned. You may also want to talk to people who have been their clients and get references so that you understand what it is they do. In some cases, you may just want to build a financial plan and check in once a year. In some cases, you may want to turn over your money for management, and in those cases, you want to be very careful that you know exactly how the money will be invested and that you're very comfortable with that approach, and also that you have some say. You want to hear from a financial advisor regularly, particularly when the market is volatile. You want to get a phone call saying, do you have any questions, or can I tell you what we're suggesting to our clients right now? So the financial advisor is one. A CPA is important if you need some help with your taxes or if there's an estate to be settled. A good accountant can be very, very helpful. And one of these can lead to the other. So you might start with an accountant who recommends an advisor or vice versa. And the third piece is a lawyer if there are estate questions to be handled or if you need to also plan for your estate in the future. There are things you can do online. But if you have any kind of substantial assets, anything over, say, $100,000 of home equity and cars and savings and retirement accounts, then you probably want to go to a professional to have a will done and plan for your estate so that things are – all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted for your state. So I think a trust team is really important. If you can't afford it, I have – explain options that you can go to. There are those nonprofit credit counseling services. They often can refer you to legal help if that's what you need, legal aid services, or low-cost services like that. And there are a number of places where you can get tax help for a reasonable cost, from things like H&R Block to even free IRS services that you can go to if you need help with your tax returns.
Karen, as I was reading through the book, I thought that this guide might also be beneficial to people who haven't yet experienced a financial setback or a traumatic event in their lives, because this could almost give them ideas on how to take preemptive actions to maybe minimize the impact of an event that could come down the road unexpectedly.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, one of the readers I had in mind was somebody who has been around. I actually have a book for young people about how to get started, but this is a book sort of aimed at people who've been around but never really engaged with the nitty-gritty. You know, perhaps somebody else did it, or they just tried their best to ignore things like 401k accounts or 403b accounts, or they tried their best to, not worry about things like interest rates. And I want to help them understand. I'm assuming they have some level of knowledge, but help them understand the steps they can take, things like why you need some savings and what kinds of questions you need to ask if you want a financial advisor, or how lenders look at you these days. Very important change in how important it is to have a good, solid credit record, for instance, and to understand what it is and what goes into it, so that when you want to borrow for a home or you want to buy a car, you've got the best sort of foot forward that you can possibly have, so that you can get the lowest interest rates and pay the least amount.
Let's talk about that credit a little bit. That's a chapter that you dedicated in the book. How important is it to make sure that your credit is sound, so that, like you said, when you're going to buy something, you get approved or you get the resources you need to keep going?
You know, it's incredibly important, and a lot of people don't understand it. I get a ton of email about this when I write about it in the Wall Street Journal. One of the things that people assume is that everybody knows their credit score, and that's not true. So the score is something calculated by the credit bureaus, and it's actually pretty hard to get your hands on your score. You generally have to pay for it, unless you're applying for a loan, in which case then you might be told what it is. But what you can do is look at your credit record, and that's really all the information you truly need to know. Your credit record will show if you pay your bills on time. This seems so simple, but it's very, very important. If you pay bills, if you paid even one bill more than 30 days late in the last 2 years, it could affect not just your ability to borrow, it could affect your car insurance. It could be something that shows up when an employer checks your credit record. It's one of those things that becomes, you know, like your teachers used to say when you're in elementary school, it becomes part of your permanent record. And it's something that hangs around for up to 7 years. So simple things like paying your bills on time can really go a long way to giving you a clean record that then helps with things like insurance and employment and future loans. You want to keep your debt levels fairly low. If you've got $5,000 in a credit card limit, that is not an invitation to spend $5,000. You want to keep it at half or less. So there are certain things that you can do. The very simplest thing, paying your bills on time, to keep your credit record good and pristine, and that pays off in spades down the road.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Karen Blumenthal, author of the Wall Street Journal Guide to Starting Fresh. Karen, how about selecting a credit card? Most people are probably inundated with offers in the mail that they get throughout the week. How does one go about choosing the best card?
You know, a lot of that will depend on your financial situation and how good you are at managing money. If you really are not into it and all you want to do is be able to charge and not sweat extra fees and all that, you just want to find a card with the lowest rate possible. And you really only need two cards at most, I think. You need one card for your regular everyday use and a backup card in case something happens. You know, on occasion there's reasons that the credit card company may cancel all their cards because their data has been compromised, or someday you've sat on the card and it doesn't work. You know, little things like that. You want to be sure you have credit because in certain situations in today's world, when you travel, when you go to a rental car place, hotels, you got to have a credit card. So I recommend two cards. You don't really need any more than that. Store cards often are very expensive and they come with high interest rates, and if you're they really just want you to spend more money at the store. So, you know, if you don't, unless you shop at one store all the time, you don't need a store credit card. And two cards is plenty. If you are careful with your money and you pay a lot of attention, you can do a lot of cool stuff with a rewards card. And there's been a lot of stories in the Wall Street Journal and other places where you can research rewards cards. You can get miles, you can get cash back. It depends on how you would use it. But if you're very careful, if you can charge and pay it off in full every month over and over and over again, a rewards card can be a really useful tool because you can get cash back or you can get miles or hotel stays, you know, that can make your life a little more enjoyable.
Karen, how about cutting back on expenses? How important is it to make sure that you're not spending more than what you're bringing in? And what is the best way to really look at cutting back some of those expenses?
That can be a real challenge. One of the biggest problems with a setback is figuring out, you know, what do I do? So my first recommendation is just to simply take inventory. In that month or two while you're just getting your bearings and trying to deal with your own emotions about whatever the crisis is, a divorce or a job loss, take stock of everything you have. Make a list of all your bank accounts and your, you know, CDs and your loans and your property that you own, your cars and any kind of special jewelry maybe or art that you might have. Make a list of that. Make a list of all of your debts and all the responsibilities that you have so that you know where you are. And then after you have a little bit of time to think about it, you figure out how much money do I have to spend each month? You know, what do I need to pay the bills, pay the rent or the mortgage, to pay the utilities? I have a whole list of things to consider. We often forget about things like haircuts, you know, birthday gifts, things that aren't every month, but that if you don't remember them and sort of work them into your general budget, when the time comes, you won't have money for them. So, you know, then figure out what is the minimum amount I need each month to get by. And if the money that you have coming in or that you have saved is less than that, then you need to make some hard decisions. There's some simple places to start. One is, what services do I have that I don't use? A couple of years ago, you know, I realized we were paying for Netflix, and we were never using it. Now, some people love Netflix, but they never use the cable services. You know, look at all your bills. You may be surprised to find you're paying for services you don't even know you have. I mean, it's not uncommon for people to discover they're paying something on the cable bill that they're not using, or that they're paying for an extra phone line, or perhaps there's additional stuff on the cell phone bill, which, as you probably know, can get really large if you've got a family. You know, perhaps there's things that you can cut out that you really aren't using or cut down to. Perhaps you don't need unlimited texting and you can go with some kind of service that's more limited that saves you some money every month. So start with the things that you don't use and then work your way back, the things that are less important to your family. And try and keep the things that are priorities, you know, the kids, maybe the kids' sports teams or piano lessons or something that you find the gym may be very important to you because it helps relieve stress and it keeps you in better health. You know, try and prioritize and keep things in mind that are most important to you. And I have a whole list of, things. Are you paying for a storage unit and do you really need it? Are there services can you cut back if you rely on housekeeping to every other week or once a month instead of more regularly? Are there places where you can cut back without turning your lifestyle upside down? And then, you know, if there aren't, then you have to make the tougher decisions. And often the toughest decision is whether you need to move.
Karen Blumenthal, author of the Wall Street Journal Guide to Starting Fresh. Karen, thank you for your time and your expertise on this issue.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you to our guest this week, Council of Prison Locals President Dale Desotel, AFGE Communications Director Enid Doggett, and the Wall Street Journal's Karen Blumenthal. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power.